White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Heretics Hour on this Monday, December 17th. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Well, a week from tonight is Christmas Eve. Gee whiz. If I was a child still, I'd be all excited. I'm actually all excited because I get a night off. Actually, I love doing my programs, but if there's a good reason, it's nice to have a break, and right at this time of year, I need one. So next week, Christmas Eve, next Monday night, there will not be a Heretics Hour program. But, you know, I can't go for more than 1 week, so there will be one on New Year's Eve. I don't really do anything on New Year's Eve, and I bet a lot of you don't do too much either, so I might have some listeners. Live listeners to that show, and thank you, those of you who are here tonight. It's nice to see you here. I hope you are enjoying the winter solstice and Christmas music that Tan and I put together for you. This is not a canned selection that we just picked up somewhere, but each song was individually selected to be, knowing that it was by a white songwriter and performed by white artists, but also because it was what I liked. I picked them out, and Tan put them all together, and I've been enjoying it very much. You know, I like hearing it, and I like hearing this particular selection that we have there, and so I hope that you're enjoying it too, and you spend a little bit of time listening to it. We'll be streaming this music between scheduled shows until December 30th, so you'll have plenty of opportunity to hear it. I actually don't get tired of them. I hear them over and over again, and I don't get tired of them, but that's some people would, I guess. The White Network has received 2 Christmas cards so far in our post office box with gifts of money in them. One is from California that I already mentioned on a previous show, and one came I got yesterday or the day before from London, England, from John. He's a good friend of the White Network. Thank you, John. Maybe we'll still get a few more. And then there's always New Year's. So, I can always wish. As a kid, I was remembering that we got silver dollars on New Year's Day for reciting a simple little New Year's greeting that was in German that we had learned and didn't have to be expert at it. Probably didn't pronounce everything quite right, but we could say it, and all the men who would be a part of our gatherings on New Year's Day, well, all the men who were in the know that this was a tradition of our folk, that is, would ask us about it, or, you know, ask us to say it, and they'd give us these silver dollars that they had collected for the day. Boy, it's nice getting all those silver dollars. When I think now how valuable they would be, I wish I had saved them all. But anyway, traditions are great. And we have to keep our traditions alive and not let them get washed away in the flood of multi-culti garbage. What is one person's treasure is another's garbage. Sorry, but that's the way it is. So tonight, adjusting my sound here. So tonight, before Professor Kevin McDonald joins me in the second hour, which I'm looking forward to, and I'm sure you are too, I'm going to try to do some summing up of what we call the protocols in order to put it or them, I never know whether to call it, say it or them, speaking about them, in some perspective. Well, this ties in with why our societies are falling apart, too. The latest horrible, shocking event is the school shooting in Connecticut, which we will be talking about in the second hour after Professor McDonald comes on. So I'll just say for now that there's 2 new developments that show me why the protocols are important. And one is the Connecticut mass murder by the so-called lone gunman that we're always assured are behind these things. And the other is a breakthrough discovery in the area of the Holocaust, which impinges in a particular way on the Elie Wiesel edifice. That thing which is of particular interest for me. You know, the second one is a good thing. The first one is a very bad thing. But this, the second one, the the breakthrough discovery in the Elie Wiesel, or actually Holocaust situation, is something that I'm very excited about. And I haven't, it just came up, and many of you probably don't know about it, and it might not sound like such a big deal when I explain it, which I'll try to do briefly here. And that is that a couple of days ago at Scrapbook Pages blog, which is the blog that someone who calls himself Further Glory runs, and the URL is Further Glory, one word, .wordpress.com, and he's the person who owns the Scrapbook Pages website. That's a very active place for Holocaust revisionist type people and Holocaust deniers. And there was a blog post titled "Holocaust Survivor Has Identified Himself in a Famous Photo Taken by Margaret Bourke White." That's still the top blog there, but it could change any time, but that's the name of it if you're looking to look for it. But the photo at the top of that is not the one I'm talking about. I'm referring to one further down that I've always called Famous Buchenwald Photo, and it's the one that Elie Wiesel claims to be, one in which Elie Wiesel claims to be among the prisoners in the bunks. So that wasn't in the blog, but in the comments following the blog, which I just got into when, you know, pretty far down, there's quite a few comments on that particular blog because of what we started talking about. And that is that, in this picture that I mentioned is with Elie Wiesel, supposedly, not really, but they say it's him in it, is a standing figure of this naked man holding a shirt in front of his private parts and, you know, standing out quite strongly in that photograph. And it turns out that we were discussing it, and the one of the commenters, who happens to be the fellow that runs Winston Smith's Ministry of Truth blog, said that he had ordered that photograph from that article from the New York Times, that made the article that was run, and I have all this information on Elie Wiesel Cons the World, particularly at the top menu where you go to evidence, I think it's evidence, and then click on photographic evidence, and then famous Buchenwald photo, and you'll see a whole long page talking about this photograph. But what happened was that this photograph was featured in a New York Times article on May 6, 1945, and it became very famous and was shown all over, and it's still shown all over. You see it all the time. It's very iconic. And so he ordered the article from the New York Times. It came to him, and he showed us, linked to it for us and showed us what it looked like. And I noticed that the naked man standing there was not in the photograph. It was just dark in that area of the photograph. And amazingly, he had not even noticed that. And nobody else had noticed it until I said so. And then they said, oh gosh, you know, so we started talking about that and how this photograph didn't have that naked man at first, and when it was taken. And then we could see from once we got to that point, you looked at that, we could see clearly that this didn't even look natural the way he was standing there. And there are a lot of things, which I won't go into right now, that were not natural. So it seems to be quite well proven, to my mind, that this is a forged photograph too, and really more important than a lot of other forged photographs, because it's so famous and it's been circulated for all these years. And it's the one that has the fake Elie Wiesel, you know, the person in there that is called Elie Wiesel. So it all ties in very much with my interest, what I'm interested in, and I'm quite excited about it. I haven't been able to write anything about it yet. I probably won't get to that until Wednesday, but I'm going to write a blog for the Elie Wiesel Cons the World website, and I'm going to, you know, make it as complete as possible, and I'll probably be working on this for a while. This is big, big stuff to me, and you might not quite understand why yet, but in time you will see if you follow this. But if you want to find out more about it right now, you can go to this Winston Smith's Ministry of Truth blog. He's got a blog on it. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, but he's, as he's good at, he shows a lot of photographs and compares them and so on. And he's always does that very well. And so I don't know if he's going to write more about it, but I will be doing a lot of writing about it. I'm not as good as he is with, technical, computer, posting things and photographs and adding things and doing all that clever stuff. But I do have somebody who helps me, and he's already sent me some pictures that he's put together. So I'll come up with something too. But right now you can get a good idea what this is all about by going to Winston Smith's Ministry of Truth blog, and it is under the or you can Google his name plus another famous Holocaust photo is fraud is the name of the blog post, rather than try to give this URL. His URL is http Winston Smith Ministry of Truth, all one word, .blogspot.com. And you'll find it there. It's not the first one anymore. It's about the third or fourth now. But, so this is very exciting. And the other thing is that, Elie Wiesel Cons the World is no longer hosted by Kodo. It's actually, I've been doing the whole thing for, almost from the beginning, but it has been hosted by Kodo they've been paying the hosting costs on the server. And Bradley Smith was seeing that some of the, work that was done by, technical administrators that I couldn't do, was paid for and so on. He's been wonderful about it. I don't have any problem at all with Kodo. They just didn't feel like it was something they could continue to take care of because they didn't think it fit exactly into their world view, you might say. And they are they're all revamped and they have a whole lot to do, and they're just taking a direction that they didn't feel like that they wanted to continue with this, although Bradley would have. But and that's fine with me because I've been thinking for some time to move it to take it over altogether. But now that I have a server of my own, it has now been moved to my server, and it is totally separated now from Kodo. So that's that's good in a way, and I can, I've always been doing it the way I want, but now I can really do just what I want without thinking, I might upset somebody somewhere, The only people I have to worry about upsetting now with my website and with Elie Wiesel, a tattoo website, is, if the Jews take after, the server company, the people who own my server, or that I bought my server from, or that I buy it from every month or whatever, however that works. So that's the only thing I would have to worry about. And I should be careful about that, because if you go too far, if you get too carried away, then they can come after you and ADL will start bugging any server company. About sites that they host that are on their servers, I'll put it that way, that they think are hate sites or something like that. So, and I can understand also why Kodo wants to be very careful about that. It's just the world we live in, and I'm going to be talking about that in this first hour, very much so, in relation to the protocols. So the only other thing I thought I would say is that I will be paying all the costs of this website, Elie Wiesel Cons the World. So any donations to it, I would very much appreciate. Now, this famous Buchenwald photograph. that we are discovering now is even more, is actually a fake photo, is actually a photoshopped photograph, or they may not have used Photoshop back then in 1945, but they pasted this figure into this photograph in some way. And this just shows, plus this photo is, you know, is claimed to have Elie Wiesel in it, which it is proven, I have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, if in my my estimation, that it's not Elie Wiesel. And if anybody would doubts that, I can point them to what they need to look at and read to convince them that it's not Elie Wiesel. But that is not changing the photograph, but what we have now is that they've actually changed it. And this being such an iconic photograph, it's kind of like, you know, what would be an iconic film or something, or an iconic book or writing that just, you know, so much turns on. And when you can bring that into disrepute, it makes a big impression. And this is what we have to do with this photograph, is make sure that it gets out and about and makes a big impression. But it is an example of the kind of manipulation that we experience and that we live with and have been living with for so long, that we don't even recognize it probably. We don't recognize it the way we should at all. And just like this photograph, I've been looking at it. All kinds of people who are revisionists have been looking at it and did not notice the things that now, once you see it, once you see what's wrong, you think, how did I not notice that? And why didn't I say something about that? And why didn't I, you know, but, I don't know. We need more than just our own suspicion, or it doesn't look right or something, you know, we need more than that. So, sometimes we just have to wait until that comes along, but we are being manipulated. And, I mentioned the shooting, earlier, and I'm not going to go into that in this way tonight, but you know, to me, that's another form of manipulation. This manipulation is getting so evil. It's so evil, but it's been evil for a long time. And I would say that, you know, we've been manipulated from throughout history, but I can't say whether it's getting worse, but it certainly is very bad right now. But we also have the ability to see it in ways that we never did. And that might be the difference, that we can see it, because of technology. Of course, it can be stronger and better done because of technology, but we also have the ability to look at it and understand it, because of technology. So everything brings the good and the bad along with it. We have to take advantage of the good part of it, is what we have to do. And, of course, I'm not too good at that, but a lot of people are, thank goodness. And we have a lot of them amongst our our fellow advocates. So to continue and try to get to where I'm going here, what has been going on has been, you know, just preventing us from having the kind of societies we should be able to have. Life should be pleasant. You know, life should be a beautiful thing, and there's no reason for it not to be. Of course, there's always tragedies that occur, and there's always, personal disease, and there's epidemics, and there's different things that happen to people. But all in all, life should be something that you can look forward to living out in a pleasant way. But no, we have a world in which just terrible things just come out of the blue, seemingly, and attack our well-being. And they affect everything in our society, our institutions. They steal our wealth from us. They steal our well-being. And these people can be called the masters of manipulation, because they have been at this for so long that they are masters of it. They're masters of manipulation. And maybe I should throw in here now, I was thinking before the hours two before the show that how did that go? Now, as soon as I try to think about it, I forget it. But it'll come back to me in a second. So I may have found my theme for the coming year, and that is this this manipulation that we're under and that we need to recognize better than we do. And I think that the much maligned protocols of the learned elders of Zion is one of the best guidebooks that we could have for understanding how this manipulation works, why, and for whom. This explains why it's so heavily condemned immediately upon mention of it, you know, by the media and by the academic world, just like the Holocaust. Every time the Holocaust comes up, they have to say that 6 million Jews were murdered. And every time the protocols comes up, they have to call it a crude forgery, a crude forgery. That's the code language. That's what we're programmed with. But as important as the protocols are, in my estimation, and from the time that they became public, they were a sensation, and people have remained interested in them, in spite of the talk about the, you know, trying to convince everyone that they're a crude forgery. Still, there's a lot of questions, like who wrote them, you know, and that has never been answered. And there's a lot of things that can't be answered. And at times, I say this is all, you know, you try to look into this and you get nowhere because there's no answer to anything. But it may be that that doesn't mean that there's not value there. I don't, you know, what this is what I'm going to talk about in the next 40 minutes. How can they be called a forgery if the authors are not known? All right. Because there's so little that's known about these things. And you'd think that in all this time, something would have been known. But all we have is repetition that they're a forgery. And we know that there's sections that came out of the book written in 1864, the Geneva Dialogues. And we know that these passages are very similar and no doubt were inspired by or copied from this book, and if the authors copied from this book, wouldn't it be more likely, though, that the protocols were written in France and not in Russia? Is one thing that I would think, that if the protocols were copied from the Geneva Dialogues, or also called a Dialogue in Hell, I won't try to repeat the long title every time tonight, wouldn't it be more likely that they were written in France? And yet most of the stories about them seem to want to place the writing of them in Russia. And of the people whose names are put forward as being the author, none of them are French. I brought up Adolphe Cremieux, but I'm kind of leaving that aside for now because of the time, the timing of it. And it does seem, I'll say this, it does seem that that most people think that the protocols were written by whoever wrote them in around 1890s or the late 1890s, because right before they became public. Usually that is the case, unless they were something, as in that Glinka story, stolen and passed around. It took a while for them to be published. Then they could have been written a lot earlier if they were in some archive somewhere. That's very possible, but you know, after reading that Justine Glinka story several times and trying to make sense out of it, I find it to be not very believable. I don't like things like that because it says that in 1884 she was in Paris working for the Tsar, kind of undercover. And that's the only date you get. And then after that, you know, one day, it says, like in a fairy tale, this Jew offered to give her some important document for a certain amount of money, and so he gave it to her, and she gave him the money, and then she translated this thing. And then eventually she was called, and she sent it to her boss in the security man in Russia, but he didn't pass it on to the Tsar. He put it in his archives because he had a deal. He was helping the Jews. So, but there's no dates on any of this about when it happened. And I don't know who this Justin Glinka is either. You know, you don't find anything about these people anywhere except right there in the protocols of people writing about it. And it's not just on this side. It's on the other side too, on the Jewish side too. You don't find anything, when it comes to the things that they claim. So what we have is a story that could just be a story. And so it ends up in the fact that this Sergei Nilus actually put it in a book of his that he published in 1905. And there's a list of publications of it before that. He says he first published it in 1901, but actually it seems as though that was just, he put it at the back of a book he wrote, but I think he self-published or he tried to get it passed around or something. I don't think it was actually published in a way that, like, you would have a Library of Congress number. So it's not actually listed. Therefore, the first book by him is listed as 1905. But I'm going to go through that list. Maybe I should go through that list right now. It might be better. I have to remember where I was and get back to it. All right. Well, we have the list, and this is the one that the man from Semitic Controversies, who calls himself Carl Rattle, put out. But it's all in Wikipedia. All of this information can be gotten in Wikipedia, and there's quite a lot of different pages you have to go to, but they're one links to another, so it doesn't take that long. And so I found all this there. It is there in Wikipedia, that the first original protocols, the date is 1901-1902, which was mentioned by a Mikhail Menshikov, that such a thing existed, something called the protocols. Now this is all in Russia, see? This is all taking place in Russia. Nothing in France or anywhere else. Then in 1903, the original protocols was published in a series of 7 installments in a right-wing newspaper by a right-wing type man. I call him right-wing, but he was what? A nationalist, an anti-Semite, supposedly, pro-Russian, you know, Russian nationalist man named Krushevan, who started that paper, and then the paper closed down shortly, you know, within a few months' time. So he just had time to publish this installment. So that's maybe why what the paper was started for. And then in 1904, there was a republication of a shortened version of it someone's third edition of Ludzhansky's Talmud, which was linked to Zionism in this. It was just part of it was published. And then in 1905 comes out Sergei Nilus's longer but still supposedly heavily edited from the original version that was in this newspaper by Krushevan. His newspaper was called Znamia. And he put it as an appendix to this book he had about the coming of the Antichrist, which is called The Great and the Small, and he added the protocols at the end as an appendix to this book. And then in 1906, another important name, George Butmi and de Kachman, published a different version of the protocols. I don't know how different, though. You see, when they say different, you don't know how different, just a little bit different or, you know, or what. But he published it as an appendix to the third edition of his book, which is called Enemies of the Human Race. So he was obviously anti-Jewish, too, and he was talking about Jews as enemies of the human race, and he included this protocols. Then in 1907, this Georgi Butmi, a Russian, he published a slightly re-edited version called Enemies of the Human Race. And so you see, the point of all this is that it's been edited, that there's been different versions according to this information, that it hasn't been just the same version all the time, although it's basically the same, I'm sure. But there's been some, it's been said that, like, Nihilus got rid of anything that would make the Christianity not look so good. And other people got rid of things that would made, something else not look so good. I can't think of it right now, but, you know, so that they were kind of editing it themselves to make it more the way they wanted it to be. So, Carl Rattle's consensus is that you can't tell if you have, you know, what the actual original was from what we have available today, you know, or how much it's been changed. But anyway, in 1911 and 1912 and 1917, this Sergei Nihilus republished his book with the protocols added, but he didn't change anything in the protocols text. This 1917 one was his fourth edition, and in that there says there was a substantial change to the protocols text and the beginning of attribution of the protocols to Theodor Herzl. I don't quite know what that, I can't tell you what that really means, but obviously Nihilus was suggesting that the protocols were written by Herzl. He always said that he did not write them. And he wasn't going to take any credit for it. He wasn't going to let anybody give him credit for it. He didn't want it. Okay, so those are those people. Now, to get back where I was, I'm just going to go straight to the people whose names are put forward as the author of... commonly put forward as the possible author of the protocols. They are all Russian. None are French. Their first one is Asher Ginzburg, who is favored by, as I said, this Carl Rattle. That's the pseudonym he uses of Semitic controversies. But also it has been accepted by Willis Carto and Michael Collins Piper. That is, though, because of their association with the book Waters Flowing Eastward, written by Louise de Shishmaref, who they have had a part in publishing that book and also in her activities and so on. She was part of the America First and the nationalist American anti-war isolationist movement in the 30s and 40s and so on. Very, very active. I'm going to read some stuff about her in a second. And so there, I think, are partial to that for that reason. But in looking at all the evidence, Asher Ginzburg is a fairly good choice. However, there's no proof for any of these people. Okay, the other one is Theodor Herzl, which I don't know who puts him forth, but a few people do. And just because he was so active at that time as the Zionist leader, and then Sergei Nihilus is a Nihilus. I always want to say Nihilus, but I guess it's Nihilus. Has been suggested as the author by some. For example, William Pierce said not that he's an expert on it, but he said he thought that was the most likely because Sergei Nihilus was the first one to really publish it, and he really tried hard to get it out there. He may have supplied it to these guys who put it in their, this man who put it in his newspaper. I mean, you don't know. It's all very mysterious and nothing is known. So, anyway, but I don't think he is, but some people do. And then there is, Paquita Louise de Shishmaref herself, who is the author of Waters Flowing Eastward and who was married to a Russian nobleman and lived in Russia until the, final Bolshevik takeover. In Russia when her husband sent her with all their money and their two children out of the country, and she first went to Britain and then to Canada, but she was well set up from then on. He was killed, but she and her two sons, their two sons survived, and and their fortune that she, at least the part of it she took with her, which seemed to be pretty substantial. And she used it for all these causes. She was very pro-Christian, very, very much Christian, and very anti-communist and anti-Bolshevik. And she was very active in that all of her life. So let's take a look at her. She published her book under the name of L. Fry or Leslie Fry. You know, I was kind of critical of this book when I finally discovered what was in it, because I had no idea, hearing about it for so many years, I never looking at it, I did not know. It was just basically composed of the protocols and some, you know, essays about it and different writings about the time and Zionism and this and that. I had no idea. I thought it was some kind of a story. I don't know. So once I did look at it, I found that I already had already read all this whole protocols book that was basically the same thing as her book, only has some differences in it. And I wrote a comment about that after last week's show, but at the White Network. If not that many people probably have read it, but I did explain some of that there. So when she came to the after Britain, she went to Canada, and then she came to the moved to California, eventually in I think it was 1926, and she. Was using the name Leslie Fry, and she signed the book L. Fry, and that's the way it was. All that was known about it for a long time. Now, I found that in looking for information about her, I didn't find much until I looked in, noticed that there was a lot of information about her in Women of the Far Right by Glenn Jeanson, who is a very liberal Democrat guy who wrote this very good book, though, The History of the Women of the Far Right in America. Even though he's totally opposed to everything they stood for, he is a good researcher and it's full of good information. And I used it to write my article, The Mother's Movement, which was published in the Barnes Review. And well, first I had it on my website, but then it was published in the Barnes Review too. A little bit shorter version than what's on my website. It's very, very interesting time period, but in reading that, I was focusing on the major personalities, and I didn't even remember this Shizmaref, who wasn't mentioned much in it, but there was a very long footnote about her, and from that I got this information that she was born in Paris to American parents. She married a Russian prince who was killed in the Bolshevik Revolution. She lived in Britain and Canada, went to California with her two sons in 1926, she believed the New Deal represented the transformation of the constitutional form of American government into that of the Kahal or Jewish form of government. This was very popular thinking back then. We're talking about the 20s. This was a time of, Henry Ford and, the 1920, the protocols, became very well known and popular. And I say 1919, maybe in 1920, and then in 1921, the New York Times the London Times came out with that exposure that it was a forgery forged from the Geneva dialogues, and that whole story I've been through. But that whole story, that does not tell everything about the protocols. You know, it just doesn't, it doesn't cut it down. It doesn't prove it's all wrong. It just is one aspect of it. So if somebody was writing it around in the late 18th century, no, in the late 19th century, sorry, they could have used that book. You know, it had a lot of some good ideas that were very similar to what the Jewish agenda is all about. So they could have used it. It doesn't mean that it doesn't really say that it doesn't make the protocols useless and therefore not worth anything. So going on with her, she accused the Jews of trying to take over the United States. These women were all doing this at this time, as they had enslaved Russia, not only the New Deal, but the Supreme Court, the Federal Reserve Bank, and the ACLU were Jew-dominated. Well, there are all these mothers' movements and women's movements, but mostly they call themselves mothers because that was more effective. And they were mothers. They were wives and mothers. And there are millions of them who organized, you know, who joined these organizations and were quite active. Of course, only certain people were the real active ones, but they had all kinds of members who paid dues, and they went to these little meetings in their neighborhoods and their little towns and so on. And, they, you know, they kept everything going. And they were all Christian. They were all patriotic American, and they didn't like Jews. They were anti-Jewish, anti-Soviet Union, naturally, anti-communist and Bolshevik, and they were anti-Roosevelt and anti-liberal and all of this. So they were clued into all of this back then, and they thought at that time, you know, they thought that they will they thought that they would win out. But in the end, of course, you know, the Jews always win out, don't they? Or New World Order crowd always wins out, no matter what kind of opposition they have. They were very strong at that time, much more than we are today. Let me say that she was trying to prove that protocols were valid, and I don't need to go too much further into her. Her most ambitious research effort was she made all these charts to document Jewish conspiracy, and she really got into how it was rooted in the 18th century, included Freemasonry, the Illuminati, the Rothschilds, Disraeli, and the League of Nations. They had it all down, you know, she had it all down there. And the results of this conspiracy were several overseas wars, including World War II, labeled that the European War for Jewish control of world's resources, financial, economic, and political, and for the destruction of Christian civilization and Aryan cultural genius. 1937, they attempted to unite nationalist forces. She did attempted to unite national forces in the United States. And she went to pretty extreme lengths. And some of these women did. Even Elizabeth Dilling was known to be sort of a fanatic. But you have to be a fanatic if you're going to stand up against this stuff. But in the end, you know, she ended up on Ellis Island during the war. She, in 1937, she participated in a convention of American Nationalist Confederation in Kansas City. And 1938, she did some more stuff and, with these big conventions. They had a lot of conventions during those years, anti-war type things. And then in 1940, she was subpoenaed by the Dies Committee. Oh, I don't know if they pronounce it Dies at that time. That's a famous senator. She fled to Italy to avoid that. But after the Pearl Harbor attack, she came back to the U.S. And she was interned at Ellis Island for the duration of the war as a dangerous alien. Well, they had that sedition trial, and they had a lot of people detained. Ellis Island, I understand, was a terrible place. I know of someone, Eberhard Fuhrer, who was there with his family after the war. They sent them there. They were going to make them go back to Germany. While they were there, these senators who were trying to help, you know, bring more sanity, got a law passed that these people did not have to be sent back to Germany, and they could be freed. And so eventually he and his family were freed from Ellis Island. But he said Ellis Island was the worst place they were at. He said it was just terrible, and the food was just horrible. Could hardly eat it. And this poor woman was there, who was married to a Russian prince and had a lot of money. She was there from 1940 till 1945 in Ellis Island. You know, her book, I have a lot of respect for her because of all the things that she did and accomplished. But she, and she wrote pamphlets too. She just worked at it very hard. But the book is the problem with the book is that it's got two different scenarios for how the protocols came into existence. But then this Father Dennis Fahey edited the current version, and I don't know, who knows what he might have done without her consent, because she may have been dead by then. So I don't know if she's dead. I actually didn't even find out where she is. I just assumed she was no longer living. But they've got Asher Ginsberg as writing the protocols, and then also the Glinka story, where they were taken out of the French Masonic lodge and then secreted into Russia. Yet if they were Asher Ginsberg wrote them, he would have written them in Russia, in Russian, or maybe in Hebrew or Yiddish. But in any case, the whole thing gets very confusing because of these stories. They don't really make any sense, and they're not consistent, and you can't follow it. You can't follow it all the way to some kind of an end. You end up, you know, losing the trail, and it goes off into nowhere. But anyway, this Ginsberg, to tell you a little bit about him, he was active, like say by 1889, he was adult, he was radical, he was a Jewish nationalist, and he was doing a lot of writing, and he wrote something in which he attacked another Jew's plan of sending Russian Jews to Palestine. He didn't really like Zionism. He thought that was a weak kind of a bourgeois type thing, which he didn't like, and he insisted in this article that Jews must first become consciously, aggressively national. He was very aggressive, and he kind of had the attitude like you find in the protocols, very tough and cruel. And he, in 1889, he formed a secret organization called the Sons of Moses in Odessa, which is in Ukraine. And he had a few members, you know, followers. And to this, it was said in Shishmaref's book that it was to this small group that Ginsberg read what is today known as the Protocols, in which the national aim is set forth in such direct, forceful language, in strange contrast to the confused, pedantic style of the Talmud. No documentation for this, though. You know, you see, there's no documentation. They just say these things. And there's a footnote, though, that says from internal evidence, the date of the protocols may be placed between 1880 and 1890. So somebody determined that if you study the protocols, and see what all the things that are said in there, because of the things that are referred to, like, as I brought up the word Panama, the Panama scandal. And I've talked about that. If all of that was in there, if it wasn't changed, which it could have been too, you know, in different versions, to fool people, well, according to that, the protocols should have been written between 1880 and 1890. Somewhere in there would have been appropriate. So this fits Ginsberg. And here's the thing between Ginsberg and Herzl. When Ginsberg saw that Herzl's conception of Zionism was an economic one, first and foremost, excluding the spirit of Jewish nationalism, he gathered his old adherents into a new secret order called the Sons of Zion, to propagate the true faith. So there was a difference there, between them, and, I don't know if I have to read all of this. He got financial help from a Moscow tea merchant, a Jew, and this allowed him to become head of this big Hebrew publishing firm that this man financed. And with these powerful organs, it says that Ginsberg could attack Herzl with impunity. And one of Herzl's friends complains in a pamphlet entitled, it has a name here, by Dr. Max Nordahl, who you know is a very well-known person. We've talked about him on the International Jew, a big Jewish leader at that time in Zionism. And this pamphlet, it has a date of 1903. And in this pamphlet, he's talking about Ginsberg attacking Herzl's novel, which was titled Old New Land, and it says that Ginsburg reproaches Herzl with wanting to imitate Europe. He cannot admit that we should borrow from Ginsburg does not want to borrow from Europe, its academies, operas, white gloves, and the only thing he would transfer from Europe into this old new land of Palestine, really, is what it means, would be the principles of the Inquisition, the way of acting of the anti-Semites, of acting the way that he thinks the anti-Semites act toward the Jews. He understands freedom is practiced in the ghetto only. In his conception, the parts are reversed. Persecutions are to continue, but this time of the Gentiles by the Jews. This does sound like the protocols, because in the protocols, you know, the Jews have the right to, it's not too much talked about that way, but they are going to rule over the Gentiles, absolutely. And, therefore, you know, it's, you get the suggestion of it while the wording is not so terrible. It's done in a kind of a smooth way. But therefore, you know, it's like Ginsburg wants to persecute Jews on a regular basis, Gentiles, I mean. He wants to persecute Gentiles on a regular basis, which is what's going on now, really. You know, we can see that. He's an enemy of Zionism within the Jewish people. And he said his conception is the exact opposite of Zionism, this writer said. He said that Ginsburg would mislead us. This writer was a Zionist. Said Ginsburg would mislead us by speaking slightingly of political Zionism in contrast to this secret Zionism, which is his very own. So from this, it's like the Zionists aren't so bad, but somebody like Ginsburg really is bad. He really hates the Gentiles and wants to kind of crush them. And the Zionists are just saying at this point that they just want their own homeland. But Herzl might not have been such a bad guy. But the thing, as I talked about last week, I think it's all merged in some way, because they might still think that they have different factions, but it's all together in one, because, well, I'm running, I don't have time to say all the things I'd like to say. Herzl, they say that Herzl might have been the author because it would have been written for the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897, but it wasn't read out there. Nobody thinks it was. So I don't think that Herzl has anything to, really had anything to do with the protocols, because they're not really Zionist. I don't think they are Zionist. Now, I went through this part. So in my final minutes here, I want to say that okay, I don't need to say that. I already said that too. Another thing is that in the protocols, it has a chapter called Text and Commentary, and it's preceding the actual protocol, stating that the book was first published in the year 1897 by Philip Stepanov for private circulation among his intimate friends. And the first time Nihlus published it was in 1901. But you see, I think those were both publishing ventures that were not, they were not commercial. If privately published doesn't count. So that's why they're not in the list of when the book was, that list that I read to you, which really starts with that newspaper, the person who put it in a newspaper in 1903. And, they don't have Nihlus named until 1905, which would probably be right, because that's when he actually published a real book. There's other people to talk about, but what I want to say is that what the protocols tells to me is that what the protocols can do for our movement in exposing what the Jews are up to. And what the protocols can do is to show people in a way that nothing else, as I've said this before, but nothing else really shows that the Jews are the enemies of mankind. And I think that in the new year, we need to take a stronger stand, and we need to put it out there, but intelligently, but that, that there's no way to talk about good Jews and so on, because, you know, the Jews prey on human weakness. That's the thing I was going to mention earlier that I was thinking about before the show started. The Jews prey on human weakness. You know, human beings have weaknesses. That's what makes us human. That's what human means. That we have weaknesses. And this is what makes human beings, well, considered to be, you know, loved by the angels in heaven and so on, because we're not perfect and we struggle all the time with our weaknesses. And, this is what makes life here. We have, courageous people, causes us to do all the things that we do. But we all have weaknesses. And what the Jews do and how they succeed and why they're successful is that they prey on these weaknesses of all other humans other than themselves. And they see themselves as, well, nobody's doing that to them. So as long as they are the ones that they see themselves as chosen, and that this they've taught themselves that this is okay for them to do. But it's not okay. And this is, I think, one approach that we need to take, and why they are the enemies of mankind, and why it's not an exaggeration or a terrible thing to call them that, and why anti-Semitism, as they define it, which is really anti-Judaism, is absolutely necessary for the rest of us to defend ourselves. And I think one thing we really need to do is to get over not wanting to be called by that name. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I will be back in 5 minutes with Professor Kevin McDonald.
Keiner dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst ein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Wir alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. er dann, egal was man auch erzählt. Du warst ein guter Mann, die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour on December 17th. I'm expecting Professor McDonald to be calling in any minute. He Skyped me that he'd be calling a few minutes after the hour to make sure that he didn't call during the break time while the music is on, because I can't answer the phone during that time. So while I'm waiting for him, I will tell you that you know, he is a professor at Cal State University at Long Beach in California, of course, California State. And he has brought up issues, issues of great importance in his career. And now he's written three very important volumes, among other things that he's written, other books he's put together, but these very important volumes are this trilogy of, and I can go to it right here, The People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as Group Evolutionary Strategy, and Separation and Its Discontents is the second one, Toward an Evolutionary Theory of Anti-Semitism. I'm very interested in just focusing on that title, because he's talks about, you know, what the causes of anti-Semitism and so on, which is very important. And then the three is probably the one that people are most familiar with, The Culture of Critique and Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. So he's worked a lot, of course, as you know, with anti-Semitism he says that Judaism and anti-Semitism cry out for an evolutionary interpretation. Well, he's a scientist, and he takes the evolutionary interpretation, whereas I find myself having to move more also toward a moral interpretation, and that's what I was doing at the end of the first hour when I was talking with you about Jews preying on human weaknesses, and that's how they do their, here he is. Well, how are you tonight, Professor McDonald?
Pretty good. Just fine here.
Oh, that's good.
Looking
well, I was just talking
show.
About your books. Good. Good. Well, I'm going to, I know you'd like me to ask you questions probably, but I'm hoping that you have already some ideas of what you want to talk about. I know you had a good article on your Occidental Observer site about Ron Unz that I started out thinking about, but now so much has happened since then. And we've had this terrible massacre in Connecticut, and then then there's still the effects of the election and what it's teaching us. So as we think about the year 2012 and how it looks from this vantage point where it's almost over, Now, what would you say were the most important events as far as white advocacy goes that took place during this year?
Well, I don't know. I it's hard to point to really good progress. That's part of our problem. We are still sort of in a ghetto on the internet. The good news is that there are a lot of radio shows. I have been probably on 10 different kinds of shows and on several more than once, like your show, magazines like Occidental Observer, Countercurrents, and Peter Brimel's V-Dare and all that. I mean, we have a lot of voices out there, and I think it's gradually building, you know. But it's, you know, we're a long ways from where we want to be. I think we all want to get to the point where we have a real national presence, where the people involved are well known to the public, where our issues are seen as legitimate and so on. And I think we're a long way from that right now.
Is our end goal to be able to form white organizations and talk about white interests in a multiracial society? Is that the goal that you see, without being so criticized, and to express white interests?
Well, that would certainly be a first step. I mean, we have to make being white and having a sense of white identity and white interests, we have to make that legitimate. And that's our first task. But I think our long-term task is to take back the country, to stop immigration, to form a mass movement where we are seen as having ideas that are perfectly legitimate, and to see us as part of the establishment. We have all these great ideas, and we can't get through. We are prevented from being in the mass media. So my view is that we have to keep pushing. I mean, and there are a lot of very positive things going on. I mean, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of places on the internet now, but we are still, you know, confined to a sort of ghetto. We're still restricted in how many people we can really connect with, and so that's a problem. I mean, I think that there are a lot of websites now. There are a lot of webzines like Occidental Observer, Countercurrents, V-Dare, and so on. But we still have yet to really get to the point where we are, a mass movement where people know who we are, what we are up to, and they think of us as being just as legitimate as the Republican Party is saying.
Well, you know, I was talking in the first hour about the mothers movement and what was also called it connected with the isolationist movement, the anti-war movement, the America First movement, and so on of the 1930s and 40s, the anti-communist, very strongly anti-communist, you know, starting with the Russian Revolution and being very anti-Bolshevik. It was Christian. It was quite a lot of Christian people, and it was considered, and they had millions of members, and they had even newspapers on their side, you know, like the Chicago Tribune and one of the Hearst papers in California. And they had big conferences and meetings, and thousands of people went, and they had big rallies and so on. And the government just brought them down. They're even able to put them all on trial at that sedition trial.
Well, yeah, I mean, the America First movement was very important, and they were successful in a lot of ways. They kept America out of the war. When Roosevelt ran in 1940, he promised to keep America out of the war. He was afraid of those people. They were very powerful. A lot of people were concerned that Charles Lindbergh would run for president, that he was very, very popular. But they did not succeed.
How they stopped that? It was Pearl Harbor. And we know Pearl Harbor was a false flag. I mean, in a sense it was. It was engineered by Roosevelt, by our side. And the truth was never told. And once Pearl Harbor happened, they set that up. Our side set that up. Roosevelt said.
Yes, yeah, so there's no question that Roosevelt.
That's how they end these things. Okay, go ahead.
There's no question that the Roosevelt administration wanted war. There's no, they wanted war, and they maneuvered us into a situation where the Japanese, unfortunately, took the bait, and once they bombed Pearl Harbor, the America First movement was dead. I mean, Charles Lindbergh went down and enlisted in the Navy or the Army. So that was just, then it was over. But, yeah, the Roosevelt administration did that.
They can always do that, can't they?
Well, they that's the problem. When you have when you have power, you use it, and so the Roosevelt administration used their power to get us into that war. There were other forces, as Charles Lindbergh said in the famous Des Moines speech in 1941. He said, there are three forces pushing us towards war. The Roosevelt administration is one, the British government's the other, and the third is are the American Jews, and their influence in the media. So, yeah, I mean, it was a full court press and it worked. And, you know, that is something that, that's one of those turning points in history where if we had not joined the war, if we had joined the other side, I mean, it was not so obvious that England should go to war against Germany. I mean, you had the Soviet Union where millions and millions of people had been murdered and everybody knew that. You had a horrible dictatorship of Stalin. You know, there was all kinds of reason why it would have made sense to go to war against Stalin. But no, they of course went to war against Hitler, and here we are.
Well, do you think that was because of a world conspiracy, even though that's crazy sounding, I know, to an academic's ears, but you know that whatever way you want to describe it, there was a worldwide plan or desire to have the outcome that we ended up having?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no question that we talked about Jewish influence. I mean, that Jews were a powerful group then. They're not as powerful then as they are now in this country. But they were pretty powerful. But that wasn't the whole story. I mean, you had the Roosevelt administration. They didn't have to pursue this policy so avidly. But they did. I mean, if Charles Lindbergh had been president, it wouldn't have happened that way.
So now we have... the Obama presidency, and we have more Jewish power than we had then. So how would we ever get anywhere? By, you know, almost by any means. I always end up being so darn pessimistic about it. But how do we through continuing to try to get people to see our point of view? Do you think that the internet makes it better than it was back then when people had to rely on the newspapers?
Absolutely. It makes it much better, but it's not by itself. It doesn't seem to be the solution. We certainly have our voices on the internet. We still have the First Amendment in America. And so we have some things going for us, but you know, it's just so hard. Most people are not very political. They want to watch a football game. They want to go to Las Vegas and gamble. They want to have fun, go on boat rides and cruises and things. And that's their interest in life. They're not really politically attuned. And so it's hard for them to see our message. The fact is that the mainstream media is very effective in policing us and keeping us out of the mainstream media. Very interesting example. Last year, Peter Brimelow gave a talk at the CPAC, the conservative activist group in Washington, and he got interviewed a little bit. I think it was CNN or MSNBC, one of them. And the big furor that they would interview Peter Brimelow, this white supremacist racist guy. In other words, they didn't want him interviewed in the mainstream media. They did not want someone turning on CNN to be to have Peter Brimelow there talking about the need to restrict immigration or something like that. So that's what they do. They restrict access to the big media. We have small media. You know, we're reaching thousands of people. They're reaching tens of millions of people. And it's a big difference. And so the average person really doesn't know that our views are out there. And, of course, you have organizations like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center. They are, you know, standing in line to vilify us, to make us sound as if we're absolutely crazy, evil, and all that. So that's the kind of headwinds we have to buck, and it's very difficult. We're starting from a very small, place, but we're getting we're getting better, we're getting bigger, and we're getting better writers and people involved. And that's what the thing that I think is really an important change. You talk about events that I see in 2012. Well, just for the Occidental Observer, we've had two or three new writers who are just really smart, really well-informed, really good writers. Mm-hmm. And people like Andrew Joyce, he's a professional historian.
Yeah, he's somebody I especially like. I like him very much.
Yeah, Andrew Joyce is excellent.
Yeah.
And he's a professional historian. You've got someone named, it's a pen name, his name is Corbulo, calls himself Demetrius Corbulo. He's also a professional academic sociologist, historian. Brenton Sanderson, writing for the Occidental Observer. These guys are very educated, very on top of things. Their articles are very factually based. So we are gradually building up a sort of cadre of intellectuals who are on page with this stuff, who understand that the West is being threatened, that our culture, our people are being threatened, and that we have to start standing up. And once you get the smart people on board, and get a significant number of them, we start to have a sort of community of people. And then other intelligent, educated people look in on our website. They can see the quality of this stuff. They understand that they have their own anxieties because they look out and they see that the world is not the way they want it to be. They see America is not the way they want it to be. They look to the future and they're afraid for their children. And, people are going to pay attention to us. And I think it's not important necessarily that we get every last white person. I think it's important, at least the way what I'm sort of directing myself to, is trying to get educated, upper middle class white people who are, again, have a sense of our problems, but are, intelligent, well-written kinds of stuff. I think there are different strokes for different folks. There are other forums, like, say, Stormfront. I think it's a very good place, but it's just different. We're trying to reach different audiences. So we're trying to reach certain audiences. We need all these different kinds of approaches. We need radio. We need podcasts. We need videos. We need written word. We need all these things, and we're getting them. I mean, there's just a huge number of things. I just the other day, I posted on the Occidental Observer Craig Boddicker's video, where he's got very, very beautifully skewers this sort of racialist rhetoric on the left. You know, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and those guys. You know, it's just very well done.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's the kind of thing. Yeah, you watch that and you laugh, and you can't help laughing. And I think that the most of Rush Limbaugh's audience, if they heard that, they would laugh and they would think this is great, But Craig Boddicker, I know Craig Boddicker, and I know he's on board with us, and he's a good guy, and these are the kind of people. He's very talented at what he does. He's got really good at video and at humorous video that makes you laugh and make fun of these people. That is what's so great. You know, making fun of someone is a very effective tactic.
Yes, it is. A lot of people say that's what we should spend our time doing, just making ridiculing our enemies. But okay, you mentioned that we still had the First Amendment, and of course we still have the Second Amendment. But now do you think the Second Amendment is going to be seriously under attack now after this terrible event in Connecticut?
Yeah, there's no question that the Second Amendment will be under attack. Every mass murder like this, the reaction of the left and the official media is to complain that there are too many guns. And so you're going to see another movement. The National Rifle Association, of course, is very strong, and they will resist it. And there's just huge numbers of Americans now. You'd be running roughshod over the sensibility of the huge numbers of white Americans if you tried to really restrict guns. So I don't know that it will be effective, but there certainly will be a move. I think President Obama mentioned some things about that.
Well, he did. He's the president. He's put himself now behind it. He's already said enough. He hasn't spelled it all out, but he said enough to say that he's going to be behind mm-hmm. a movement to restrict guns. It's not, but of course, it's not the guns why in this instance does supposedly this woman had 5 or 6 guns? Why would she have 5 or 6? I don't know. I don't believe all that stuff that I'm told by the mainstream media. I don't know what I believe about that, but in any event, it's kind of amazing that something so terrible would happen right before.
It is amazing, and
yeah,
it's very terrible, and it's horrifying. This is unprecedented. To go after children like that is just, it's just something that is just almost can't even be conceived. And I mean, I don't know what happened. I think we're still getting a lot of information. She was into guns, apparently, from what I've seen, credibly, which is sort of unusual for a woman.
I really haven't had time to read much about it. I really haven't. I've been involved in trying to do other things, so I don't have the best information about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all sort of catching up here and trying to fathom this. I mean, I'm a psychologist. My interest is, you know, what diagnosis does this guy have? I mean, this is so far out, so far. You know, this is unprecedented. I mean, I can't think of any crime like it where you just go and you kill your mother and then you go and kill a whole bunch of children and some adults. And you know, it's just there's nothing like it. And so this person has to be severely, severely disturbed. And the sad thing is, I mean, if there's a lot of these things, you know, there have been quite a few in the past year. You had the situation in Denver. Yeah, there was a shooting in Milwaukee where several Sikhs died. There was a shooting, and there's been several of these this year. And when that happens, I think that's what gets the anti-gun lobby going and gets them some power and some credibility because, you know, especially with this, society's not going to put up with children being murdered like this. So, I mean, at least one thing that's going to happen, obviously, is going to be much better security at the schools.
They've already got so much security at schools. You know, Professor, I think I have heard people saying, using the argument already, which makes a whole lot of sense to me, that if more people had guns, they could defend themselves. And the reason that these mass murders happen is because the only people that has the gun is the one that's doing the killing. And do you think that would be an effective approach for us to take, you know, who want to save our constitutional amendments, to really argue that we need more widespread gun ownership and teaching people how to use guns, and that citizens should be prepared to defend themselves? I've heard people say that if the teachers in the schools had guns, they could defend their classrooms. And in many of these cases, it would have been a better thing.
Yeah, that is the standard NRA argument that if they outlaw guns, the only outlaws will have guns, you know, kind of thing.
Well, that's right.
And there is that is, you know, and you know, the fact is that more and more people are buying guns and they are white people and they are afraid. So I one reason I would be very opposed to any kinds of big restrictions on guns is I do see this as a reflection of how white people see America now. They see America as a dangerous place for them. They see these minorities continuing to increase. They are concerned that the federal government is being taken over by the far left. And they are, you know, concerned. They're concerned about crime. They're concerned about being a minority and all those sorts of things. So my understanding is that there have been more guns bought in the last year or two than unprecedented.
But you know, when there's high profile cases, it's always a white person, a white perpetrator. And when they're black or Hispanic or whatever perpetrators, they don't play it up or they haven't done these kind of things. It makes you wonder why these white people go crazy. And the other people don't go crazy. They just do ordinary.
Well, in fact, what you said first was right. There are a lot of black mass murderers. They are not as publicized as the white ones. So they definitely exist. I mean, just in Los Angeles here, there was this guy who killed, I don't know, 25 women, mostly prostitutes, a black guy. There've been a bunch of black serial killers. But for some reason, in the public mind, they have this stereotype that it's a white guy. in any case, you know, this guy, Adam Lanza, was not someone who is politically motivated. He's got some severe mental disorder, or he had some severe mental disorder. He's not like he hated blacks or anything like that, or you just don't know. No one what's going on in his mind. I mean, it's just absolutely out there.
Well, if it was known, the first thing I read about him is that he was schizophrenic, and then I haven't read that since. And then sometimes, then they put out stuff that all these people that knew him talked about what a sweet little kid he was and a quiet guy and all these nice things. But, the one idea that comes to my mind too, is not just everybody having guns to protect themselves, but that people who are known to have disorders should not be running around loose and free because they're supposed to be treated like everybody else. You know, this started with the handicapped and so on, that you wanted to treat them just like everyone else. So you had the retarded children. We used to call them that. Now we're in the same generation. You can remember how it was back when we were in school and young. Things were said the way they actually were, and you didn't have retarded children, whatever, and you didn't have autistic children, and you didn't have this and that in the school systems, you know, in the classrooms, trying to everybody treat them like they're just one of the same. And if you have kids with these other severe mental disorders, the same thing goes on. They don't want to separate them from the rest of their peers, and so then they're out there loose.
Yeah, I think you could easily argue it's not really a failure of our gun laws. It's a failure of psychiatry. They simply did not. Psychiatry is still in the dark ages. I teach a course now in psychiatry, sort of psychiatry of children. And it's just a wonderland. There's just very little consensus about anything. The diagnoses are not reliable. That is, if a child is diagnosed as depressed or something like that, you can't get agreement among these different people what that is, even what the symptoms are. And it's just a mess. And so the psychiatric profession has a lot to answer for here, and our laws. And yeah, as you're suggesting there, we've deinstitutionalized people who are completely insane. There are a lot of the homeless people have mental disorders, and we've mainstreamed people who should not be mainstream. I mean, there are some certain children who should not be in classes with other children, and this is part of this movement. It is part of this sort of leftist attitude within society that all children should be able to be in a classroom. And there's no such thing as real mental illness. People should be allowed to be out in the streets and do what they want and so on. Well, that's a model that came in the 1960s as part of the leftist counterculture that became the establishment. Well, we're seeing some of the results of that. I mean, these people are just so far beyond comprehension. They really need to be in some kind of treatment facility with no option of getting out until they have they really are cured, which is, a pipe dream at this point. We don't cure any of these serious mental illnesses.
You think they depend on drugs too much, and then the drugs aren't really acting in everybody the same way, or they're not doing what they think they're going to do?
Well, these drugs are oftentimes they have huge effects on the person where they can hardly function. You know, like the drugs for schizophrenia are basically massive tranquilizers where they can hardly function. So it's very distasteful. They don't want to take these drugs. And so it's just, they don't really have any good, psychiatric medication is not as good as one might think. And if, for example, treatments for depression, these antidepressant drugs that they dispense like candy, I think is just a crime. I mean, these drug companies are pushing these drugs. Huge numbers of people take drugs. An awful lot of people don't really need them. They're getting massive side effects and creating sort of zombie-like people. A lot of these drugs, what they do is dull emotions, so people don't have emotions. And they're sort of like walking zombies. And I don't know, it's just a
well, the medical and drug, particularly psychiatric-type drug profession is just as dangerous to our society as other things that we talk about. I mean, there's all these industries that have just seemed to have gone to heck, you know, and like the psychiatric profession, is it dominated by Jews, would you say?
Well, there has been historically certain Jewish input. I think, though, that actually Jewish influence is probably way less than it used to be when psychoanalysis was big. What has come in, I mean, I am in favor of biological psychiatry, you know, understanding these mental disorders in a biological manner. But unfortunately, it really hasn't, I don't think, has really produced the qualities of medication that you would, that I think does occur for some other illnesses, for physical illnesses. These psychiatric illness, drugs, they tend to affect a whole lot of parts of the brain. They're not, you know, specific for one little part of the brain that may have a problem. And so they're like a scattershot thing. And so when you try to treat depression, you really affect all the emotions and that sort of thing. So I'm very skeptical about psychiatric medication at this point. It's just that the science of psychiatry has not moved as quickly, I don't think, as other aspects of psychology. But in a way, it's easier to understand normal psychology than it is to understand these mental disorders. And even when we understand them, treating them means you're going into the brain extremely, extremely complex. You're changing things around. It's very hard to affect one thing in the brain. You're going to affect a whole lot of things. Because you know, a lot of these drugs are based on neurotransmitters. Well, these neurotransmitters exist throughout the brain. And so if you take a neurotransmitter that affects serotonin, say, or something like that, well, there's serotonin in a whole lot of different systems. And so you're going to have massive numbers of side effects. Psychiatric medication is still in the dark ages, I'm afraid. It's just not a good area. But it's, you know, Adam Lanza, it sounds like someone who perhaps was schizophrenic. He was just way, way out there in a different world, a different time zone than any of us are. And I don't think we can really understand what's going on in his brain. I'm not sure wherever we'll.
Do you think that it's a terrible idea to think in terms of defective people, and that there are defective people, and that we no longer, because of this liberalism we're talking about, are allowed to speak like that, and that everybody deserves to get help, and everybody can be helped, and like you say, that in the helping they tend to make people worse, and they make them into monsters, you know, and none of this stuff works, and you know, all this becomes so impossible to talk about because it's like, you know, so totally politically incorrect to say that some people are defective and they're never going to be right.
Yeah, I think, you know, what probably should have happened to Adam Lanza is that his mother should have put him into a treatment facility. And he should have been, you know, seen as someone who really couldn't deal with the world, that there were severe problems with this kid. And I heard that,
well,
that
why is it up to the mother to do that? Well, of course, we don't want the state coming in and telling you. But, you know, at the same time, how can a mother make that judgment?
Well, she seemed to be aware that he had severe problems. And she, you know, apparently quit her job to be with him all the time. That she was afraid that he would turn on her and didn't trust him and all that. And so she knew that he had these demons. Well, if she had taken him into a treatment facility, and if there were good psychiatrists there, they would have been able to spot this kind of thing. They would not have let him out on the street. I really do think that a lot of people do have to be, you know, confined, and then you have this huge homeless population. Most of them have psychiatric disorders of one form or another. In the old days, we used to put them in psychiatric hospitals, and that was seen as cruel or something, but being on the streets is very, very cruel. And then
people don't understand that, and they blame whoever they blame. You know, they blame, you know, the business people and so on. They blame the political system or whatever for these people. Then they really, it's really psychiatric. They're not out on the street because they have to be, because they can't find a home.
Yeah, they're just
available.
Very, very sad.
Well, there seems to be a political agenda behind the whole thing.
Well, I think, you know, the changes to the psychiatric hospitalization laws were basically part of the sort of leftist culture of the 1950s, of the 1960s. Had a huge effect on those practices. And I think it is part of the rise of the culture of the left that mental illness is seen as something that's sort of a problem of living, and these people are really okay, and that kind of thing. You just sort of let them out in the streets. And it was almost fashionable, I remember back in the 1960s, to see people in mental hospitals as more sane than the people on the outside. I mean, it got to be that silly. It was just that sort of out of touch with reality. Mm-hmm. And that mentality is not really with us anymore. But sadly, I do think psychiatry, as I say, just is really in the dark age. We don't have any good treatments for these disorders for the most part. And certainly
maybe
something
sometimes
like,
if people's brains, you know, the brain is, like you say, I mean, how much it's very complex. And if somebody's brain is kind of something wrong in it, it's always going to be wrong, and there's no way to fix it that we have now. And like you say, well, these people would just have to be institutionalized.
Yeah, these drugs are sort of scattershot drugs. They affect way too many things. I don't think that, I mean, personally, I if I had a problem like depression, a little depression or something like that, unless it was very, very severe, I wouldn't go near those drugs. You know, in other words, try to get along without taking those medications. Psychiatrists and other doctors are pushing these pills. The pharmaceutical industry is pushing them. Painkillers, for example. I mean, there's so many doctors are pushing painkillers. You have huge numbers of people taking what's really sort of legalized heroin. And, you know, it's just a very, very bad situation. Right in Los Angeles here, we've had several doctors have now been prosecuted because they have prescribed these painkillers just willy-nilly to all these people, and several have died because they OD on these things. They get prescriptions from X number of doctors, you know, and they just game the system. They're just addicts, and they eventually die, and these doctors are completely irresponsible. They just make money at it, you know, and that's what they see it as.
Well, do you think it seems to me that a good approach for our side would be to use the argument that the liberal left that came in the 60s has caused a lot of these difficulties that we're having now are becoming a crisis, where it ends up with you know, these 20 children being murdered, and then they want to blame it on guns and people who want to own guns. You know, wouldn't that be a good argument for us to use, you know, as a whole group, that it's this liberal movement, because the liberals are always going after the right wing, or what they call them, or whatever they want to call us. We should turn around and go after their whole movement.
I think it is a failure of the psychiatric profession that quite possibly stems from these changes that were made in the 1950s. 60s, and it is part of the culture of the left. So yeah, I mean, I think that when you have someone like this on the loose, that he should have been in a treatment facility. He should not have been wandering around. And it so happened his mother had these guns and so on. It was just a horrible thing to happen. But you can't just blame it on the guns. I would agree that
no, you can. It's a culture.
There's a lot of other blame to go around here.
You know, I mean, when I was in grade school, I mean, nothing like this would ever happen anywhere. It was never even dreamed of. Nobody would come close to doing such a thing. And people had guns, and maybe not the way they have now, but, you know, I remember this little boy showing me his father's guns at his house when we were in fourth grade. You know, but it's just a difference in all these influences that we have around us that are causing people to go berserk.
Yeah, I think that there were. I mean, I remember back in 1960, early 60s, I think there was a guy at the University of Texas went up into the bell tower and shot a bunch of people.
Oh, I remember that so well.
Yeah. So that was a very, very, very unusual. But I think now, you're right. I think that if you look at these multiple killings, you know, where someone just on a shooting spree, seem to be more and more common now. And yeah, it's part of the culture guns are available. You see all this gore in movies and video games. And certain kinds of people are very affected by that. And then you have people who are frustrated with life in some way, and then they get angry. And they, quote, go postal. And they, you know, they go and they kill their boss and five of their workers and things like that. That's, you know, that's been going on, again, as something that seems more common now.
I think drugs have a lot to do with it. Because, like you said, people are taking all kinds of drugs, not just recreational drugs, so-called, but, you know, other drugs that they get in their system.
It's very easy to get a prescription for a drug. You just go to your doctor and say, oh, I have anxiety. They'll give you a tranquilizer. They'll give you, or you're not feeling very good. Well, they'll give you an antidepressant. I mean, it's so easy to get these things. They do affect your behavior. And there are a lot of side effects. I mean, if you listen to the side effects, when they give the commercials, because they have to do that by law, when they give the side effects for antidepressants, I mean, it's a long list of things, including things like suicide, including all kinds of horrible things.
Yeah.
People are continuing to prescribe those and take them, and we're a very drugged nation right now.
Well, I think this is the kind of thing we should be talking about when they start bashing into our interests, you know, and blaming it on guns and so on. We ought to bring all this stuff up and say it's the 1960 revolution in this country, and the drug and sex revolution and so on that changed everything. Everything's changed in the schools, and this is what has led to what we have now.
Yeah, I think people on the left should ask themselves why so many people are buying guns, and it's because they are afraid of the culture of the left, basically. They are afraid of this massive immigration. They're afraid of all these laws that are busing or mixing all these peoples together. And so the culture of the left, I think, is what's producing a lot of the tensions and anger in the country. And is making an awful lot of people go and buy guns. I mean, I believe after the election this year, it's huge. The huge number of permits were given out for guns. People are concerned. They're afraid of the future. They don't understand. They feel that their country's been lost to them, and it's a natural thing to be afraid. And so, buying guns is one way to feel a little bit protected. So we'll see more of that.
Well, there we need to make that clear to everybody. We need to make sense out of all that. So, what do you see? You see, well, then we're talking about the election and the fallout from the election. Do you really think that there is any good can come from all this secessionist talk?
Well, I would hope that there would. You know, it sort of came spontaneously after the election. I wrote a thing on it, but I don't think that was any part of it. But you still saw a lot of people, you know, putting around petitions and so on. And I think it reflects the fact that they feel the country has been lost to them, that they really don't have any recourse anymore. And so what they are doing is trying to think of a way out. And say you're in Texas or Idaho or someplace, it makes a lot of sense to say, well, the federal government's not working for us anymore, that we have to have some way of getting, you know, seceding. Or if not seceding, at least getting control over things like immigration. If individual states could regulate their own immigration, that would be a very different thing. I mean, the federal government has taken this power and they are holding on to it, and it's been upheld by the courts. But you know, if the states could get control of immigration, you'd see a very different kind of ball game going on.
Well, absolutely, because the red states would not allow it, so everybody would have to go to the blue states.
Yeah, and again, you don't need to have a complete secession in order to have some of the laws, the powers to be given to the states. Which are actually rightfully theirs. I mean, what's happened historically is that the federal government has taken over more and more and more of our powers. The states have gotten less and less. And so, you know, if we could have a movement, that's part of the American tradition is states' rights. And if we could argue and get, you know, we wouldn't need secession. We could just argue that immigration is something that states ought to be able to control. You know, but again, if there was a big movement, if major mainstream politicians got behind it, and it got on the ballot, you know, it would change things. It really would change the atmosphere here. People would realize that they can't just go down this road and shove these things down the throats of the American people as they have for the last 50 years. That's what's been happening. They've been shoving these things down our throats, and we just can't get to the point where a lot of people are they realize now what's happening. They see the country changing dramatically. They see the country getting away from them. They see the situation where it's going to take at least 70% of the white people to vote on their side, you know, to vote as a group in order to get a national candidate, into office, like the president. I mean, you're not going to be able to elect a president without 70% of the white vote, probably by 2016. And then by 2020, it'll be, 73%. The stakes are higher and higher.
Yes, you're right. Well, there's a story I just saw before coming on the program tonight, and it says Republican South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley announced Monday her decision to appoint Representative Tim Scott, who is a Negro, I added that, to succeed Republican Senator Jim DeMint, who's retired or something. And this is a decision she deemed historic. Now, this Scott is supposed to be a Tea Party star. That's what they call him. And he's going to be the first black Southern senator since the late 1800s. He won election to the House in 2010, just 2 years ago. And, now he's, and this governor of South Carolina, turns out she's, an Indian American. So there you go. See? So she says that it was important to her, that as a minority female, that Congressman Scott earned this seat for the person that he is. And she says it's a historic day for South Carolina. It's a great day in South Carolina and all this stuff. So this is the way it's going. When the more of these mixed race people that are there, the more they're going to bring more non-whites in.
That's right. I mean, they 80% of non-whites voted Democrat. And now these Republican elites are bending over backwards. They want a comprehensive immigration reform. They want to get on board with immigration. And then, this appointment that you're talking about, the governor herself. Yeah, I mean, they want to get the Republican Party to not have the image of being the party of white America. But I'll tell you, it's going to be hard to do that. I think that white people have gravitated to the Republican Party. And in the primary season in 2016, these white people are not, which are the base of the Republican Party, they are not going to go, I don't think, for a moderate Republican who wants all this immigration, who is happy with all these non-whites being, in these offices and so on. We'll see, but that's my prediction, and that the primary. That a Republican, whoever gets out of the primary is going to reflect the values of the base, the white base of the Republican Party, and they don't want this stuff anymore. And we'll see what happens, but that's what I think will happen.
Yeah, well, this woman, and it's too bad this is South Carolina, and now they're going to have a black senator.
It's very ironic because South Carolina was the state that was sort of in the forefront of secession back in 1861. So, South Carolina was a sort of bastion of the most conservative elements in the Confederacy. And, I imagine there's still an awful lot of South Carolinians who are pretty horrified at that appointment and at the direction of the Republican Party. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, we've only got a few minutes left, a couple minutes left, actually. Professor McDonald, is there anything that you would like to add that we didn't get to talk about or we haven't talked about? Anything about your site or your plans?
Well, I do have an article on the website now about the fact that white people are being discriminated against in our most prestigious universities. It's very interesting. I'm based on some new data by Ron Unz, who published an article in the American Conservative. This is an article that really shows that white Americans are being severely discriminated against. That compared to the academic achievement, whites should should be at a ratio of 15 times what they are compared to Jews, considering the population differences and so on. But in fact, Jews are actually outnumber whites, non-Jewish whites, at Harvard and these other institutions. So there's just massive discrimination against white Americans by this Jewish elite that has gotten to where they are, and once they've gotten there, they're going to prevent anybody else from getting in there.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you'd like that information to get out. I did read that, you know, myself as soon as it was put up. This is the kind of thing we need to be talking about. And you can talk about it on the Occidental Observer. You probably, your articles there probably have more comments than I see anywhere else. You really get the comments. Nobody has time to read them all. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much and wish you a very Merry Christmas, Professor McDonald.
And a Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
And thanks for inviting.
Looking forward to a new year. Thanks for being with us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next time. No, we'll see you 2 weeks from tonight.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.